And we're not going to record. I'm very pleased to introduce the author of the case and the person who's going to be moderating this discussion. Dr. Barry S. Fogel, Barry and I serve on a board together. Barry is a behavioral neurologist and neuropsychiatrist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He also, as a businessman, he was the scientific founder of two companies, one in medical information services and one in central nervous system drug development. Barry received his MD from the University of California at San Francisco. He did his clinical training at Harvard and Stanford, and he got his MBA at MIT, where he was a Sloan Fellow and later a visiting scientist at MIT. Barry has served as an expert witness on issues related to executive functioning, self-awareness, financial decision-making in people with medical, neurological, and psychiatric conditions common in later life. Barry, we've got three groups, and why don't we go with the first group is with Amita. Did you select a spokesperson?
We did. So Mindy's our spokesperson.
So we had a big discussion about sort of where to start with this issue. Given my legal background, I had a lot of thoughts about what he could possibly do and his competency and a lot of that. But I think what we concluded was that Susan said we would start soft. We would try to get the two outside board members to meet with Mike and to try to get him to discuss what's going on in his role, because it appears that he's much more of a chairman of the board at this point rather than a CEO. The daughter's functioning as a COO, but also consulting with him. And depending upon how that went, we would then like to see a full board meeting, because these people have fiduciary and other responsibilities to the company, and there are lots of issues to get on the table. One thing that we went around about was sort of his competency and whether he really is he competent to stay in the business and to have a significant role. One of the things that kept coming up was this whole issue of he and his secret wife, their public displays of affection, the fact that some people might be leaving the company, their reputation. One of the issues that I raised also is, as a trade school, are there registrations and requirements for them that could impact their business? It's a substantial business. So the first step we thought was to try to get a meeting of the independent directors with Mike, Maureen, if possible, to kind of just talk about issues. Group, did I miss anything?
No, I think that was an excellent summary.
Okay, thanks.
Group two, Jim Anderson, did your group select a spokesperson?
They ganged up on me.
Ah, okay. John Ela, take it away.
We looked at it in some similar ways. We thought the next step should be for the two outside directors to meet just with Mike, probably offsite, and figure out where he's coming from on all this. Some of the symptoms of mental incapacity are opinion. Some of them may be a mountain into a molehill, and some of them may be very serious. So it's, what was he thinking when he made that type of decision? And once that's understood, then it's a lot easier to figure out a course of action. It's very odd that we thought that the outside directors don't typically talk to Mike or Maureen, but spend most of their time with the CFO, particularly after having been on the board for so long. So we wondered what that relationship was all about. We thought that the secrecy of the marriage and the giving away of that much of the company certainly was concerning. With him owning, it appears, all of the stock up until that point, that's something he can do. He said, don't worry about the tax, but we're wondering how that was handled. And did he do it through an actual granting of the stock, or is that through a will? So there are a lot of questions about what really happened. What are the real facts of the case? And the outside directors need to know a lot more about what's going on in his head, both for the short-term risk of will some of the key people leave. And certainly if Maureen's doing a good job, there's real concern about her leaving, because where is her future? But we also thought that if the CFO was aware of all of this and no plan to deal with it, that that would be even a more likely person to exit the company, which with the turmoil going on right now, that may be even more problematic. So does Mike think Maureen is competent? Does he think she's not? And how do we get it so that the company doesn't blow up once Mike passes?
I got to ask you, John, that's a beautiful background behind you. What is it? What's it a picture of?
That was my backyard in my last house. And I'm
wow, really nice.
Thank you. It's a hobby.
Very nice.
My work.
And group three with Christine Vaughn. Did you select a spokesperson? Group three with Bob Nadel, Christine, Barry, yeah, and Mark Florence.
Yeah, Bob is. Bob, unmute.
Bob, unmute yourself.
Bob, unmute yourself.
Good.
So, yes, I got voted. And for those of you that heard my case last month, when the CEO was being, the company went to $100 million. And then there were all of these signs, not just about the CEO, continued to be very rigid and whatever. The signs, the business signs were that it went from $100 million to $60 million to $20 million to worth pennies. This case is different in that, regardless of the signs, which you can then choose to ignore, the company continues to be $100 million. And that gives a lot of people a lot of opportunity to say, what's the expression? We don't need no stinking badges. We're $100 million. And, if you go back to the formation of this company, it started, as this great idea, and it worked. And they got people, and they got people to stay. And until the unfortunate confluence of these two illnesses, and one of the illnesses leading to Maureen having a new mom, who was her own age, that everything was really very good at $100 million. And, there are very good answers that we came up with, such as, and you've all said them already, that it would have been good to sort of start, you don't just put it on the agenda, you start by meeting with the outside directors and get them to, you wonder what the outside directors have been doing all of this time, but you start with the outside directors, you get them to ease into a conversation with Mike about, what is really going to happen now, what is the role going to be of Miranda, and things of this sort. But there are bigger questions about the business practices of this company. Where is the role of the accountant who says, tell me what's happening here now. We're going to, issue what kinds of shares here. What's the role of the attorney? This company basically, unless we don't really have the full picture, the company basically doesn't have a stock plan. It just has some form of incorporation, I presume. It's not really stated here. Presumably 100% of the shares, in some incorporation, is in the hands of Mike. And now he has said, in some words, I'm giving 30% of that to Miranda. So that has to be memorialized in some way through accounting and legal. And where are those two firms, presumably at $100 million, they are actual real firms. And where are they in going to the board of directors and say, you know, what, where is our fiduciary responsibility in doing that? So, you know, we later learned that we are now in a situation. Do you want me to reveal this, you know, Barry, what, where it actually stands, or do you want to tell us?
I think Barry should do that. Barry?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, and anyway, let me just make one more sentence here. My own feeling is that this $100 million company got to be $100 million in the most amazing way, because the employees don't seem to have any future shares in this company. No one has any equity in the sense of shadow stock. You know, no one has any promise that if we have any capital markets transaction that you'll participate in this. They seem to be well paid. They seem to have stayed on, you know, loyally over a long period of time with, you know, and happily and so on. Anybody else? Did I miss any other points that we said we were going to cover to the rest of those that were in the group?
Okay. Barry, you want to take it? You want to comment on the comments?
I can. And this is, first of all, let me get put a little more color in here. The company is it's a limited liability corporation. They went from being a one-member limited liability corporation to being a two-member limited liability corporation. The way that Mike managed to secure the loyalty of his people is actually, I think, not unfamiliar to people who ever worked at a university, where surprisingly people can have quite long tenure at a university even though they don't have any equity. And it's something to do with feeling part of an organization that's doing something worthwhile that people find meaningful. And it's also something that's related to quality of work life and benefits. So they had very flexible work schedules. They had lots of corporate fun, big bonuses when the business had a good year, a wonderful defined benefit pension plan. So that a person worked for that business and then they retired, they were not gonna have to worry about anything. And so no one was gonna get rich by working there, but you were gonna have a sweet work life doing something worthwhile, helping people qualify for jobs, occasionally getting a bonus 50 or 100 grand to have a good time with. And these things actually are appealing to people. And this was part of their secret. How do you retain good people? Well, you find out what makes them happy. And Mike was pretty good at doing that. This is a great example of a kind of an autocratically operated family business. And there are a surprising number of these where someone's successful, they build a business, and some combination of personal charisma and sort of taking care of the employees and so on, the thing works without the usual apparatus of stock options and so on, equity incentives. And as several people have pointed out, so where are the external directors and where's the lawyer and where's the accounting firm? And why aren't they sort of leaning on this guy and on Maureen for that matter, to be a little bit more rigorous in how they're planning for the future? What I can say as being an expert in litigation, actually part of the inspiration for this case is one I am an expert in. The business was only worth $60 million, but their litigation has been going on now for several years after the death of the entrepreneur, the Mike character. And when I looked over what was going on prior to Mike's death, what was so striking, there were all these opportunities when an accountant or a law firm could have said, wait a minute, Mike, you should be thinking about X, right? But they didn't do it. What they did, and these were famous law firms in some cases, they simply drew up beautiful documents that embodied every legal rule, you know, all the, you know, cover yourself that you could ask for. but never challenged anything. Never said, you know, here's what can go wrong with this. Here's the litigation that might take place after you're gone. Let's bring your daughter and your wife into the room together and talk about how they're both going to either win together or lose together. Nobody did that because nobody saw it as being their job to do that. And I think that, you know, what people are suggesting the outside directors do is that they sort of get together with Mike and say, Mike, there's some really serious unfinished business here. What I would add to that is I think they need to impress upon Mike how actually badly wrong things could go. And this has two dimensions. One of them is things going wrong now, because people get a sense, the employees, senior employees get the sense that the business's future is not so certain. And given that they don't have an equity stake, you know, and given they're all been all sort of reliant on you know, Mike's benevolence, maybe they should be looking for something else while their, you know, their credentials are hot. But also to say to Mike, you know, the business has been going right, great, but don't kid yourself. If things fall apart after you're gone, whether being gone means being dead or gone means being too ill to work, if things fall apart, then the two people you love the most in the world are going to wind up on the short end of the stick, you know, because if the business really goes down the tubes, neither your wife nor your daughter are going to wind up getting what you'd like them to get. So that the wealth that you want to pass on and the legacy you want to pass on in terms of this really good trade school that's very successful at getting people jobs and all, it could all go down the tubes if you don't make plans to deal with some of this stuff that are a little bit more formal than what you've done now. And we have no doubt about how good you are at being fair to the people who treat you right and good to the business. You're not always going to be around to do that. And that's when things fall apart. And whether that because you're ill or because, you know, you're dead, doesn't matter. There will come a time when if you're not going to be the one to call the shots and things could go downhill very rapidly. And then I guess what you're saying, if that didn't work, if there was no way to get to Bill, I mean, get to Mike, you know, then it's more complicated because he's not incompetent. Definition of incompetence. He's nowhere near incompetent. He has bad judgment. But, you know, if bad judgment was incompetence, I mean, you know, there'd be tens of millions of people be incompetent. I mean, it's just not, you know, it's there's no way that power is going to be taken from him by legal means. It's really all about someone bringing influence to bear. And, so I would throw out to the group here, would anybody think that there would be reason for or legitimacy in any of the directors talking directly with either Maureen or Miranda separately from talking to Mike? Bob?
Yeah, I was going to ask, you said it's been in litigation for a couple of years. What's the argument? Before you answer the question about what to talk to them about, the question is, what's the litigation? What did they decide to fight about? I mean, they had a $100 million business, and
the bones of the business are still worth a lot of money, and that's what's being fought about. And the argument for that between the interested parties relates to undue influence, and essentially that Maureen exerted undue influence on her, her husband to, you know, do things that are really contrary to his own, to his own true intentions, taking advantage of his dependent position. But the business suffered, but it wasn't destroyed after the death of the founder. And the litigation is about who is going to be able to.
So they're arguing about an ongoing business.
Yes, correct.
That about what's the right way to manage it?
About who's going to own what part of it. So in other words, the business day-to-day is being run by other people. The business in this case was a partnership legally. So the remaining partners continued to run the business, although the majority share of the business is what's being fought about. But the operation of the business is now being handled by the surviving partners, which is why the business didn't totally go down the tubes.
Barry, I'd like to when I was reading the case, the thought I had was, it seems to me that one of the checks of good corporate governance, whether it's a public company or a private company, whether it's profit, for profit or nonprofit, should be that the bylaws of the board of directors should state that when the CEO turns 55, that CEO should get a routine neuropsych evaluation, a cognitive functioning evaluation every 5 years. I picked 55 because at that age, no CEO would be threatened by that. Whereas if we're looking at somebody 70 years old, they might be threatened by that requirement. But I would, if I was writing bylaws for a board, having read this case, that's what I'd want to put down to protect the investors from a CEO who's getting cognitively impaired and the board doesn't know how to deal with it. Barry, any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's complicated, Larry. I mean, I think, the world is full of examples of inspired chief executives who would probably flunk some neuropsychological tests have done outstanding things with their business. I mean, like, I'm not sure that, Warren Buffett would have a great score on a reaction time test. So what, right? And I think the problem is that depending on what business someone is in, and depending on the decisions and duties that the CEO has, I'd love to give the example of a executive that I went to. He wasn't the chief executive, he was a number two guy at a very large insurance company. And he had Parkinson's disease, he had some other problems, and he was beginning to show some signs of cognitive decline and physical frailty. But he had been the number two guy at this insurance company for a long time. And the chief executive, recognizing that there were some changes in his function, but still greatly respecting his judgment and insight into things, said, I want you to have a different job. I don't want you to routinely go to meetings anymore. What I want you to do is have the office next to mine. I want you to read the Wall Street Journal every morning. And then I want you to come into my office for 15 minutes and tell me something that I don't know and maybe I don't want to hear. And in 1987, spring of 1987, this guy walked into the CEO's office and says, I think the stock market is looking a little weird. I think we ought to reallocate the assets that we are, retaining, to pay claims. And we ought to really lighten up on our equities. Well, that one piece of advice was taken by the chief executive and it saved the company a couple hundred million dollars. And why could this guy do this? It wasn't because he could do well in a neuropsych test. It was because having been in the investment business for a very long time, he recognized a pattern in the transactions and what was going on in options markets and things like that. Put it together in his head and he said, it looked like this the last time the market crashed. And so I think the problem is, and the reason I wrote the case with Maureen kind of being more and more effectively the CEO, to make it difficult to say that this guy is, over the hill, right? You have no doubt he wouldn't do well on a neuropsych test. Had chemo brain, he's not going to be able to do well on the test. But maybe had a great suggestion about what city they ought to put the next campus in. Or, was very good at, through his personal network, recruiting a really good person to be the local dean on that campus. And that is really fundamentally the problem, that it's unusual for even a healthy person by the time they get in their 80s to be as competent at everything as they were when they were in their 40s, but that may not be relevant depending on what their role is. And that's the dilemma that I see. You know, I know what others think about that one.
I was actually interested in Larry's suggestion, and I know we don't usually do this, but just if we could just do a general poll, has anyone ever seen in bylaws a suggestion that a CEO have a neuropsych test at any age? Because I have to be honest, I've sat on a lot of, I've never seen that. Is that something new?
I've never seen it.
Oh, okay. All right. I was just wondering. Okay. Thank you.
Good night. Can I make a suggestion? Because Barry is involved in a company here that's in litigation and they're slugging it out and they don't seem to be getting anywhere. So I'm going to offer something. It may be very vanilla, but what would be a possibility anyway? It's vanilla. Offering each of these parties separately a business coach. You know, not someone from LinkedIn, please, but a business coach that you find. And not the same one, but at a point where each of them has had some coaching and counseling and is ready, gets to the point where, okay, maybe I'm ready to talk because we both are partners in the same company, that maybe we can then get to a point of seeing if we can move 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees closer to talking about how we work together, because it actually is in our best interest, since we work or are partners and have financial interests in the same company, to get it back out of the courts and into how we run the company.
And Bob, this is exactly the point I'd like to sort of put out to everyone here. It's clear that the kinds of, at some point, the right intervention in a situation like this is not going to be legal, and it's not going to be financial. It's going to be some kind of thing, whether you regard it as educational or psychotherapeutic or whatever, but it's going to be some kind of interpersonal thing where conflicts are going to be brought out. People are going to hash things out. People are going to learn some alternative ways of thinking about the situation, and hopefully they're going to be able to, stop being in conflict and start thinking about how they're going to enhance the value of the whole thing rather than, you know, basically wear it down. And when I think about what lawyers do when they do business operating agreements, they do estates and trusts and the like, they practically never would bring in a psychologist or a family therapist or a coach or a screenwriter or someone who's going to sort of really say, let's raise your consciousness about all the ways these things could go so that you can think in a more creative way about it. Rather than thinking of you're either a winner or a loser, it's either we both win or we both lose. And I don't see any law firm that, say, does estates and trusts that routinely thinks about doing this when they have a large estate and there are potential beneficiaries with different interests. It just isn't done. It's not the norm. And I absolutely believe that if it were the norm, it would happen. You know, if a lawyer would say, you know, not doing this is as remiss as not auditing the books, you know, you have to do this. But that's just absolutely not the way it is. And I would like to throw out to you, do you think it should be the way that, you know, if you bring in the lawyer to revise the operating agreement or the ownership papers, or you bring in, someone to work on an estate plan that involves a large family business. Should the norm be, you know, a sort of a parallel process of education, values clarification, conflict resolution, and so on, and people saying, I cannot promise you you're going to avoid litigation and avoid crashing the business if you don't do this. Would that be realistic?
Let me act in my role as timekeeper. We have 5 minutes left, so this will be the last question for the evening. Any reactions to what Barry suggested? But particularly Mindy, who's our resident lawyer.
Well, I mean, I've seen situations where people have, well, two things. One is a lot of good lawyers will think about, in family business situations in particular, will bring in advisors, will bring in coaches to help family. I've seen that. I also think that a good business lawyer will want to understand the circumstances and the situation without just drafting a document, and want to really understand what roles people will have and how to work it out. If they don't get that kind of good advice, they're not dealing with the right people, in my mind.
And I was going to add that if that's going to happen, it really has to happen before they're at the point of litigation, because now it's too late. And second is that both parties want to be open to finding a solution that's win-win and not win-lose, or it's not going to happen either.
I found it fascinating that that these parties are more interested, I won't say in being right, but versus what's better for the company itself. And I think if in the scenario, both females definitely love this person, you would think they would care about the legacy of the firm, care about what they were doing versus trying to quickly kind of go down the legal avenue. And I'm not saying it was quick, but just in my mind, you would think that litigation would be the thing that both would try to avoid, because you get less, you both get less because the pie got smaller because you took the hits around the company, basically not doing well because of this skirmishing that's done in the public. So in my opinion, it would behoove you not necessarily to hide it, but to try to almost adopt that mediator mindset in order to be able to make a better outcome in the long run. So maybe that's a little naive, and maybe Mindy, that makes business for you tough if everybody wants to try to work it out, but it seems to me that they would serve themselves better.
What I didn't understand was, is it a limited liability company? Is there a partnership? It sounded like there was a complicated structure.
No, not really. It was an LLC. It was a single member LLC. And then the guy revised the structure to give a piece to his wife.
Right. But you said that there's a partnership running the business. So I didn't
know. No. You mean the actual one that sort of prompted the case. Now, the actual one that prompted this case was a partnership. It was a professional corporation. Actually, it was an accounting and money management business.
Barry, I want to go back to the issue that I raised. And if, let's say I'm on the board of a company, and we have a job description for a CEO, which is a standard CEO job description in terms of what a CEO's job's responsibilities are. Could I send that CEO to you every 5 years for a cognitive evaluation just to get a basic clear versus not clear answer?
Larry, here's what I could tell you. I could tell you, given this job description, these are the aspects of the job that this person would be very strong at. These are ones where there would be potential weakness. And these are the circumstances under which the weakness might become evident. Because that's what I could tell you.
And in my role as a board member, that's all I need to know.
And you see, again, the reason why I put this case the way I did was, it is just because Maureen fills in all the blanks that her father can't fill in, that so much doesn't get dealt with that would have been dealt with, say, if it was a public company and where the roles of the CEO and the CFO were very well defined. The point is, in reality, Mike hasn't functioned as the CEO in years, right? right. in reality.
But not officially.
You see, not officially, right.
But the board, you see, this is where I think that this board and the company has, because of its $100 million success, which everybody has said, hey, well, look what we did, has managed somehow to avoid doing every crossing of a, how does it go, crossing of a T, dotting of an I, that it needs to do to keep its employees and to assure its future success. And I think, you know, I know I said it, so I'm going to repeat it. Yeah, I am going to repeat it. I think the best thing to do now, and I don't think we can go backwards, unfortunately, I think we have to answer Barry's question. I think this has to come out of the courts, away from the lawyers. Sorry, I have a lot of lawyer friends, but this has to come away from the lawyers and be put in the hands of people who can help them psychologically. Susan, I just looked you up. You were a coach. So I hope you're agreeing with me. I think this needs a business coach, two business coaches, not the same coach, two business coaches who can get these people to say, you know, we both do work for the same company. I really think it's time that we realize that we need to keep this thing. Is it 60 million rather than 100 million? At 60 million, we both win if each of us makes a little bit of progress toward getting to talk to each other. And by the way, I know it sounds funny. It sounded funny to me, mom, because she is now technically.
Yeah.
One of them is mom and one of them is daughter by this, but okay, I'm the only one that thinks that's funny. But they both win by that. Otherwise, this thing turns out to be like the case I presented a month ago, where it's now, I know it's not public, where it's now traded on the pink sheets and it's worth 0.6 cents.
Yeah.
Yep. We are so going to have to.
I'm sorry, I'm a little hard ass, but I think that's where it has to go. I really think that's what's going to happen. I mean, I think that's what's going to happen.
Well, at this point, we're going to have to stop. I want to thank Bob, and I want to thank you for your contributions for this case. Probably in 2 weeks, it will be posted as a podcast on our website, boardoptions.com. And next month is November, and so we have decided very wisely not to compete with Thanksgiving, and so we'll be having the seat at the table a week before Thanksgiving. So we'll be sending you out some instructions and then a case shortly. So again, thank you very much, Bob and
Barry,
and we look forward to seeing you next month. Thanks, Barry. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Barry. That was good to
hear. Barry, say hi to my son.
Appreciate it.
Anybody want to follow up on any of these things, feel free to drop me a note.
Yep, please
do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.